Please join me.
Thank you. I'd like to begin with a five-line history of the Vietnam, of the Iraq War, if you will, in the form of questions. What have we learned? We've learned that there may be some limits on the use of American power, as John Miller has expressed very well and wittily. Why did we learn it? Because the thing has cost so much and to apparently little effect. Why the problem happened? Because it was an opportunity and it seemed easy. What's changed? I think we've lost some faith in the ability of massive power to effectuate political change. And what can we expect? I'd say not much. I think probably a version of more of the same. Now, it's a pessimistic prognosis, but let me explain. Everybody agrees that the war in Iraq has been a disaster. And although it often is described as invoking freedom, democracy, victory, etc., but like an earlier war in a far-off land, what it evokes in effect is stalemate, quagmire, and syndrome. Now, the Vietnam War lasted more than a decade, took the lives of 58,000 Americans and 5 million Vietnamese, brought down one American president in disgrace and resignation of another, and spawned the so-called Vietnam Syndrome, which lasted for about 30 years. After the quick expulsion of Saddam Saddam's armies from Kuwait, Bush the First declared, "We've licked the Vietnam Syndrome." But, licked it or not, he refused to march on Baghdad to depose Saddam Hussein or to occupy Iraq. In effect, the war in Kuwait was merely an imperial police action to protect a distant province and ensure access to Gulf oil, the sort of thing that major powers engage in when they can and as often as they can. The same syndrome held for Clinton, the Vietnam Syndrome. He kept U.S. out of civil wars in Yugoslavia and Rwanda. I mean, he involved himself in the Yugoslav War, but from above. Despite the pressure of liberals urging what they call virtuous intervention, he learned in effect something from the disastrous foray in Somalia. Of course, everything changed. Not that Clinton was an ideal president, but everything changed after he left with the election of George Bush and his appointment of ambitious neocons and aggressive nationalists to high office, and the empowerment that resulted from the attacks of 9/11. And this set the stage for replacing Saddam Hussein with a compliant puppet and provide political support for a frightened and angry public. So I think I would argue that just as ignorance of history and culture of Vietnam triggered the earlier war, so a similar ignorance of the Middle East and its politics and an ideological straitjacket led to the political and human disaster of the Iraq War. Now, the key to the Iraq War, I would argue, is the disparity between the anticipated results and the actual ones. The anticipated results were, of course, to tame the forces of radicalism and Islamic fundamentalism, to enhance the security of Israel, to contain Iran, whatever that meant, to increase the democratic base of U.S.-backed oligarchies, to ensure a steady supply of oil, and to move the air bases from an insecure and unstable Saudi Arabia. The unannounced goal was to transform Iraq into a permanent base for the projection of American power and political influence in the Middle East and Central Asia. Not a surprising agenda for an imperial power. A perfectly logical objective. And the project dovetailed with the neoconservative goal of extending American power in the Middle East, buttressing friendly neighbor regimes, Jordan, Egypt, Saudis, Gulf State, and of course, enhancing the security of Israel. This was reinforced by liberals who had urged U.S. intervention in various civil wars during the Clinton administration. It was liberals who urged intervention in Bosnia, intervention in Kosovo, intervention in Somalia, intervention in Rwanda, as an exercise in the virtuous use of American power. Many of these people were persuaded by political science theories about democracy as the key to world peace, and they believed that American power was purified by America's good intentions. So I think in this sense, one could argue that Iraq was not only a neoconservative war or a nationalist war, but also a liberal war, or if you will, a neoliberal war. Like Vietnam and like the war of aggression in the Philippines a century ago, it was an imperialist war launched in the name of liberal ideals. Liberal ideals always go down better with the public, of course. And this is one of the central reasons why it will be so difficult to leave behind us. There is a continuity in the Iraq War. It was partly because of the desire to provide a democratic veneer for this imperial war that the invasion and its aftermath was handled so incompetently. The Bush team would have been better advised to have pursued a Central American or South American solution, a Pinochet solution, if you will, to have installed another Saddam or even a Musharraf to prevent a civil war, thereby securing the oil, the bases, the air bases being built in the central, eastern deserts of the country, and preserving something very important for an imperial power, an aura of invincibility. In effect, that was bungled by overambition. The result was that the United States under Bush has been revealed not as an imperial power, which everybody knew, and which in some circles would enhance its reputation and actually advance some of its interests, but also as an incompetent power, an incompetent imperial power, given to irrational behavior and an inability to advance or even fully understand its political and economic interests. The clear winners of the Bush administration bungled adventure are the intransigent Islamic fundamentalists and, down the path, the emerging great rival of China, which everybody is already preparing to defend against, everybody in Washington at any rate. Now, so looking back on the Iraq War, one could agree with the words of a French cynic long ago, describing an equally ill-conceived enterprise when he declared that it was worse than a crime, it was a blunder. It'd be hard to think of a single action, which after all was only a very limited use of American power, that did so much to undermine the moral and even the military reputation and influence of the United States. It divided NATO, emboldened radical movements in the Muslim Kayan states, stimulated recruits for Islamic terrorist groups, creating a Shia Kayan state for Iran and Iraq, undermined American influence over non-Arab Islamic states like Indonesia, and increased America's financial obligation to China. China today is in the position of the United States a century ago. Rising industrial, economic, and military power. And America is like Britain. Its legions scattered, its economy in relative decline, its authority and credibility diminished. And the consequences domestically are equally grave. Legions of mercenaries, a threat to civil liberties in the name of security. And such traditional freedoms are not easily removed. Once easily removed, are only with difficulty restored. Despite huge infusion of money into the military, with a concentration on high-tech weapons and armadas, the United States is less unsuited than ever to fight the wars it is most likely to continue fighting. And I don't think we're done fighting regional wars. The prospects for the vaunted new American century are certainly much dimmer. Islamic fundamentalism has been fortified, NATO riven by dissension, fueled by U.S. efforts to split its cohesion, and the rise of nuclear anarchy, So what was vaunted as a Pax Americana is giving way to a global struggle for power fueled by nationalism, religious passions, ethnic hatreds, and resource scarcities. In short, a Hobbesian world. This is a grotesque inversion of its intended purpose. It has shattered the hegemonic illusions of the sort expressed by a Pentagon official who probably declared before the war, "We make our own reality." Well, a different reality has been made. So by weakening American economic power and the illusion of invincibility, a military invincibility, the war has undermined the nation's ability to sustain an interventionist foreign policy. U.S. military might, with its concentration on high-tech weapons and air and naval armadas, is totally unsuited to the kinds of wars which the U.S. is likely to fight. Dependent on unstable or unreliable sources for oil supplies, distrusted or even despised in much of the world, unable to call on its own citizens to fight its wars, the U.S. has been not only weakened but humiliated by this war of choice. So projects for a so-called new American century are much weaker than they were 5 years ago, as a nuclear-armed Iran becomes a reality. And gradually and dramatically, weakening America's ability to control through intimidation. Even outside the Islamic world, we see a weakening of America's position. NATO riven by dissension, Latin America is beginning to slip from U.S. control, Japan becoming more nationalistic, and the small nuclear club threatening to turn into something that could resemble nuclear anarchy. So what has been a more or less voluntary Pax Americana is becoming a global struggle for power, fueled by nationalism, religious passion, ethnic hatreds, and resource scarcities. In other words, the Hobbesian world. Significantly, the U.S. election campaign has so far been marked by the total absence of any serious discussion of the Iraq War, or even of foreign policy in general. So, what does this mean? Does it mean that we are now in the grip of an Iraq syndrome, sharply inhibiting our willingness to use military force to advance America's political and economic interests? In other words, a kind of retreat from the positions that we've engaged in previously? Judging from the disastrous headlines in from Iraq, it might seem that the retreat, a retreat from the objectives of the Bush Doctrine, are likely. But I think it's very unwise to assume so. Unwise to assume that a change of political parties in Washington will mean a sharp change in our foreign policy. There is, after all, only a hair's breadth of difference and a lot of empty rhetoric between the foreign policy of the Bush administration and most of its critics. That narrow space between the parties has been true for more than 60 years. When after Pearl Harbor, 60 years ago after Pearl Harbor, that the Republicans scuttled isolationism and embraced internationalism as part of a U.S.-directed world order. Since then, the only significant difference between the parties have been on domestic issues and the role of the federal government in the economy. The saying that the business of America in business is equally true under Democrats as under Republicans. It began with the Monroe Doctrine, continued with the McKinley seizure of Cuba and the Philippines in 1898, with Teddy Roosevelt's doctrine of American political and economic hegemony in the Caribbean, with Wilson's taking the United States into the European War in 1917, and Franklin Roosevelt's good neighbor policy. In other words, preserving and extending U.S. economic interests and assuring prosperity was the goal, just as was the goal of the Marshall Plan after World War II. Throughout the Cold War, the United States has pursued open markets and free trade with both democratic and authoritarian governments. The U.S. and the Soviet Union avoided direct confrontation while fighting proxy wars in Central America, Africa, Middle East, and Central Asia. Ronald Reagan, both publicly and secretly, of course, financed Contras in Nicaragua, rebels in Angola, Mujahideen in Afghanistan, and even Saddam Hussein in his war against Iran. Similarly, it's worth recalling that the Clinton's intervention in Bosnia was motivated more by a determination not to lose control over NATO than by the humanitarian appeals of liberals. George W. Bush, his rhetoric aside, fits within this pattern. Bush put economic relations with Russia and China above geopolitical differences, kept NATO under control by diluting its political cohesion through the expansion of NATO into Eastern Europe, and expanding trade accords with Latin America. Although Bush disastrously overplayed his hand in invading Iraq, his goals have been in line with those of his predecessors: to ensure U.S. access to vital resources, to gain bases for the projection of American power, to protect U.S. client states, and to build a firewall against radical forces, both political ones and theological ones. That's it. I would argue that American foreign policy under Bush, George W. Bush, regardless of who is elected in November, will not be greatly different than it was before Bush. The style will be smoother, but the substance will be similar. There will be sweet talks and summits instead of diktats and ultimata. And though the rise of new power centers, China, India, Japan, or restored Russia, may inhibit unilateralism, a belief in the virtue of the indispensable nation endures. In this, conservative ideologues and liberal interventionists are in accord, despite the nuances of rhetoric. Today's neoconservatives are yesterday's liberals, after all, and even today and tomorrow's neoliberals. Both believe in an America's global mission, in the virtuous use of American power, and the spread of American political and economic influence. And the democracy agenda as an instrument of that mission. After Iraq, there are probably no more crusades fought by Americans or by mercenaries, but rather a return to proxy wars like those under Reagan in Angola, Nicaragua, and Salvador. And as an example, one could look at the recent war on Islamic fundamentalists in Somalia, conducted by U.S.-supplied forces from Christian Ethiopia. Although Bush's policies, as well as his presence in office, have been discredited, it will be very difficult to disentangle from them. It's true regardless of who is elected in November as the next president. John McCain, of course, has said he would keep American troops in Iraq for 100 years, a figure that sounds hyperbolic until one remembers that American soldiers still stand guard in Korea more than 50 years after that war ended. Bush will be gone by January, but the next president will unavoidably follow with any greater restraint, and certainly a different vocabulary, a familiar agenda. What is that agenda? Maintaining a significant force level, even if they be mercenaries in Iraq, trying to block Iran's nuclear ambitions, engaging, however futilely, the Taliban and its allies in Afghanistan and Pakistan, trying to contain the rising tide of anti-U.S. populism in Latin America, and brandishing a democracy agenda, if only as a hypocritical camouflage for intervention. The United States won't voluntarily relinquish its position of primacy. No great power ever does. Nor its interest in the Middle East that triggered a violent retaliation, nor its two-century-long position in Latin America, which is now being increasingly challenged, and by China's quest for resources in the region. So don't bid goodbye yet to the Pax Americana. The United States is weakened, but won't retreat to its shell. Retreat is not in the American character unless it can be camouflaged, and I think it would be very difficult to camouflage when such interests are involved. to be sure, American authority and prestige has been compromised by incompetent and ideological-driven leadership and a corrupted political system. But the U.S. will remain for some time the world's dominant military, economic, and cultural power. The American century is winding down, but not yet. What alternatives? Sometimes people talk about, oh, creation of a balance of power system. Well, first of all, I think that's a long way off. And secondly, it's no panacea. The balance of power did not keep Europe from a self-destructive war in 1914. And if the U.S. may be forced to accept this, but certainly not voluntarily, and not for a very long time. If one can say that the Iraq War has been a disaster by every measure, it's also worth remembering, in Adam Smith's words, that there's a great deal of ruin in a nation. And this nation has a lot of ruin left before it becomes inhibiting. Great empires rarely collapse or even lose their ambitions after a colonial skirmish. They usually reorder priorities. Thus, there may well be an Iraq syndrome, but it would be less than its advocates hope or its critics fear. And finally, I would just say that we have to look at the Iraq adventure, if you will, indeed the whole democracy project, as not simply an aberration of George W. Bush or a plot imposed by Republican nationalists and neocons, but as a liberal endorsement of a wider imperial agenda, subscribed to cynically by the right and naively by liberals. It will endure because it is legitimization of American power and the fig leaf of a national will to power deeply embedded in American history and political folklore. Perhaps its most powerful manifestation is in America's secular state, Woodrow Wilson, with his goal to redeem the world, and legitimately so, because of America's incontestable virtue and, above all, its good intentions. Thank you.